This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, I'm Charles Gitonga, and here is what's coming up for you on this edition of Focus on Africa. Namibia has some of the highest rates of cervical cancer in the world. We'll tell you why.
A lack of awareness, the information to reach all the people in Namibia. Second one will be people don't turn up for screening. And the other factor is actually just stigma or cultural beliefs. When people believe that cancer is a condition that is caused by witchcraft and the like.
And as Rwanda and South Africa vie for pole position to host Formula One in Africa, we look at who's ahead and what the benefits might be.
A lot of economic benefits. You're talking a spin-off of jobs from the local businesses, especially the hospitality industry. Talk about the hotels. A single Formula One team comes with a lot of members. Talk about the engineers, the directors, the technicians. It's massive. So that's a lot of money coming into whether it's Kigali or Joburg.
It's Thursday, January 30th. First, let's talk about artificial intelligence. A Chinese-made AI model called DeepSeek has shot to the top of Apple Store's downloads, stunning investors and sinking some tech stocks. Its latest version has quickly impressed AI experts and caught the attention of the entire tech industry and the world. What makes DeepSeek so special is the company's claim that it was built at a fraction of the cost of industry-leading models like ChatGPT, which is owned by American research organization OpenAI. But how does it compare to ChatGPT? And should AI fans be paying attention to where their favorite chatbots come from? I caught up with someone who's keenly following this recent trend, AI expert Michael Meshie, based in Nairobi.
So DeepSeek is a new AI model that's come out from China. And how this new LLM works, this new large language model, how it works is it's built on chain of thought, which basically means it has a reasoning capability. And so when asked a question, it goes step by step in trying to figure it out, just able to regurgitate an answer that's just a fact. But when it's problem solving, is what it does. It's also built with a bit of knowledge distillation, and what that is using a larger model to train a smaller model so that it can have the same kind of performance with the larger model.
So, very, very basic, what would be the difference between an application like this and, let's say, an online search?
With this, you're sort of getting an answer right away. With an online search, mostly on the browsers, what you're getting is certain keywords that link you to various websites, and then you have to go in there and sort of read and get the answers. So this is more direct in terms of giving you an answer. You have a question, get your answer. You don't need to go through the whole search across the internet and go to the second or third page of your browser to find what you're looking for.
So not long ago, we had ChatGPT come to the market, and it was very exciting. You know, ask it questions, ask it to write you a letter to your boss, or, you know, for assignments if you're a student. But DeepSeek also seems to have gained global attention. What does it offer that makes it very different from other artificial intelligence apps that have the same capability?
I think the first thing that it offers, obviously, is that it's open sourced, meaning anyone can take the model, especially people want to build around it in terms of building AI applications or building solutions, and even researchers have the freedom to take it and try and improve the model. The other thing that made it quite popular, obviously, is price factor on APIs for those who are using APIs to onto their own applications, because the price
what
is significantly
APIs?
Low. APIs are application interfaces. So this is basically how you get two application programmable interfaces. Those are APIs, which is basically how you get one program to talk to another program. So one program makes a request for certain pieces of information, and program two takes a request, prepares the response and sends it back to application one. So it's just a way of allowing applications to communicate between each other. And so now this allows you, whoever who's building, maybe you're building a chatbot for your organization, the cost of doing that with DeepSeek is significantly cheaper than most models out there, especially at that level of performance. So the cost factor and the fact that it's open source and it's actually meeting benchmark performance of other models out there has really brought a lot of people towards it. And it's now everyone is sort of rushing to try out the model and see what else it can do.
What do you think people on the continent would be more inclined to using? Will it be the excitement of trying something new or still going to, you know, something like ChatGPT, which has been around for a while and people sort of have know what to expect?
I think people might gravitate to DeepSeek primarily because it's open sourced. And I'm looking at this from the perspective of you have the capability to build on top of it. And it's not just one model that they have. They have the R1 model, which is the one that's compared to ChatGPT. But then you have the V series of models, V1, V2, V3, and another set of models, which are things you can just download for free and you can build on them. And this, I guess, creates an opportunity where for Africa as a continent to get into sort of get more into this AI space in terms of now there's a very powerful model out there that's open sourced that will require less resources to build upon for our use cases as a continent. So I think it creates a new opportunity for us as Africa. And it also shows how Africa might in the future maybe look at using other forms or other techniques to also build their own models. This model was from the papers that have been released was built quite differently from how OpenAI and other large language model providers have been building their models. And even the hardware is written in the papers to be not the latest hardware from this company. So I think it's quite of value to see that there's an opportunity for Africa to build as well. We think we've been shown these papers show us how, and in terms of use cases, we have open source models that we can build and experiment on.
And it was assumed that to create an AI app, you know, it would take a lot of time and cost huge amounts of money. There is information that DeepSeek was built at a fraction of what, let's say, OpenAI, which is the company that owns GPT, spent, you know, in terms of creating that application. Do you think this inspires African developers, just to carry on from the point you're making, to be thinking of an African model to create these kind of solutions?
Personally, for me, I've felt inspired. I've been talking to other developers in country where we meet or when we have some conversations over social media, and it's inspiring what's been done. And we're like, if we can get this level of performance without the burden of cost and the burden of the infrastructure, which is ideally hard to get, then we have an opportunity to leverage our existing technology to get more performance from artificial intelligence. And that's now exciting. So I think that's sort of like setting the pace, and hopefully a lot more developers pick it up from there. And we start experimenting on use cases. We start experimenting on how we can also do knowledge distillation, chain of thought, and all these things on less infrastructure and less cost.
There's a big concern around censorship, especially in countries where, you know, free speech and open access to information really matter. When it comes to that, how is DeepSeek approaching it? And could you compare to, let's say, OpenAI's approach with ChatGPT?
I'd equally say they both have their own form of censorship. I've always felt that as long as you're not the one developing the model, you will find censorship that suits who developed it. So the examples of certain questions that ChatGPT will not answer, that DeepSeek could answer, and there are questions that DeepSeek will not answer, that ChatGPT will answer. I guess this speaks to both geopolitics and the issue of censorship. It also means that Africa also has to be careful maybe when picking what models to use to understand also where is that alignment in terms of censorship, and would we still be able to access factual information that's hidden behind censorship?
And in terms of data privacy, which is an issue that's coming up in terms of the ability of these AI solutions and these applications to store our data, should we be concerned about where the data is stored? But first, how much data do they pick up anyway and store?
If we were to compare the two, just from a light reading of their privacy statements and their terms and conditions, obviously they are quite different. The tone is different between the two models. Obviously, OpenAI states that you can opt out of your own data being used for training. DeepSeek takes a broader look at it and they say they might use, they might not use. So privacy is quite dependent within their policies. They mention that even upon request of deletion of your account, they may delete in terms of what you get to see, but they may keep historical records in terms of your chats and everything. From glancing, comparing the two privacy statements and their policies, as well as their terms and conditions, I'd say DeepSeek is a lot more, I don't say infringing on privacy, but they do have a lot of access to the information you feed the model when you're prompting the responses. There's quite a lot which they are doing that OpenAI isn't doing in their terms and conditions.
So a lot has been happening between America and China since, you know, DeepSeek came in. And one of the things that has happened is that, you know, OpenAI, which is an American company, they say that Chinese rivals, including DeepSeek, are using its work to develop their own applications and to advance their own work. What are your thoughts on this?
For me, it's a question of intellectual property as well as growing the body of knowledge. Ideally, your intellectual property has been infringed upon, then I believe you have a right to seek reparations. In terms of, is one company using another company's model to train their own model? I think that happens. One of the things I was reading online is that they used questions and answers from ChatGPT to train the existing model, and that allowed them to make a very small model that performs quite a lot. Whether that infringed on any IP is what needs to be proved. The sort of the origins of all this training came from scrapping the internet, and a lot of concerns were some sites felt their copyrighted data was used to train this model without consent. So maybe it's, things are turning back full circle and the pre-existing models are now feeling the pinch of that, because now you can perform question answers and then take that data and train smaller models. But I think in terms of just for the body of knowledge, I think it's a very good step in terms of finding more use cases for pre-existing models and also leveraging a lot of creative ideas to build cheaper and equally as good models.
AI expert Michael Meshie in Nairobi. A recent report highlighted the rates of cervical cancer in Namibia. It says the disease is 3 times higher in the country in comparison to the rest of the world. We wondered why that was the case, because cervical cancer is one of the most preventable of all cancers. Doctors in Namibia are advocating for greater access to healthcare and for women and girls to access the human papilloma virus, also known as the HPV vaccine, in order to reduce the prevalence of the disease. I've been speaking to Namibian doctor Laina Iyambo, who's a clinical oncologist. I began by asking her to explain what is cervical cancer.
So basically, cervical cancer is a lifestyle disease. So usually there are risk factors that are known. And then in its early stage, there wouldn't be symptoms usually. Symptoms usually develop when the cancer has advanced. But some of the symptoms, if we can mention, it can include pain in the lower abdomen or in the lower back. It can include abnormal vaginal discharge. It can include the postcoital bleeding or abnormal bleeding between menstrual cycle. Or for the women who are already in menopause, it would present in abnormal postmenopausal uterine bleeding.
So why are the cases so high then in Namibia? It's 3 times higher compared to the rate in the rest of the world.
It's a lot of factors that are contributing to that. The main one is a lack of awareness, the information to reach all the people in Namibia. Namibia is a vast country with a lot of population living in the rural areas, usually with long distances to health facilities. So lack of awareness. And then the second one will be then that people don't turn up for screening for the cancer to be picked up early enough. That's also attributed to the long distances from where people live to the health facilities. And the other factor is actually just stigma or cultural beliefs. When people believe that cancer is a condition that is caused by witchcraft and the like. And then people are usually also just scared of treatment when they hear of the side effects that comes with cancer treatment. People are then scared to just go through treatment.
So let me back up a bit to something you said at the beginning where you described this as a lifestyle disease. Could you expound for us?
So by lifestyle, it basically means that it's usually a condition coming from something that one does. And this is mainly through sexual behaviors, multiple sexual partners, unprotected sex. And also in our setting with a lot of HIV, cervical cancer is quite common in patients living with HIV due to the lowered immunity.
So given what you've said, do you think that is a factor as to why many people don't want to go for screening as well, because this is an area that people don't want to discuss a lot?
Maybe, maybe not. Because, you know, when one comes for screening, it's their choice to answer questions truthfully or not. Unless we are saying it's someone who is well known in their area of residence. Other than that, I think people are really just scared of going to seek for medical attention for the cancer to be picked up. And that, I think, it has to do with stigma also. When you say someone who is known to have multiple sexual partners, when they go to health care facilities, then they are scared that people already know of their sexual behavior, then they feel a bit guilty that the condition came more from their behaviors. And the other thing is also that in Namibia, we still don't have a human papillomavirus vaccine, which is proven to protect people from cervical cancer. So it's available in the private sector. However, in the state sector, it's still not available. So that is also contributing to the high incidence of cervical cancer in our setting.
So I wonder if you'd recall the first diagnosis that you made on cervical cancer and what the reaction from the patient, of course, without disclosing a lot of information, what the reaction was.
I'm a clinical oncologist, so I usually see patients who have been already diagnosed by the gynecologist. But in some instances, we get patients reaching to us without being told or maybe not understanding quite well. And it only hits them when they are referred to a cancer center. It only hits them then that they have cancer. So the reaction is usually very emotional, the anxiety. Patients are crying. They feel like they see death because that is what cancer is believed to be. When someone is diagnosed with cancer, even themselves, they feel it's already a death sentence, despite the fact that cervical cancer is a treatable, curable, preventable disease.
And talking about prevention then, what can people do to actually prevent themselves from getting this?
The first thing would be to indulge in safe sexual behavior. That is, avoid multiple sexual partner, protected sex, and then going for screening so that in the event when, like in our setting where I said we don't have HPV vaccine yet, in the event where cancer is not then prevented, at least to go for screening so it's picked up early in a state where it can still be treated easily and get cured.
So let's talk about that vaccine, the human papillomavirus HPV vaccine. How come it's not present in Namibia, given the statistics that we are looking at?
I would say it's lack of implementation from the policymakers, because if you look at the fact that cervical cancer is causing a lot of morbidity and mortality, the cost, even if the vaccine is expensive, I mean, the cost currently being used to treat cervical cancer to manage patients who are on palliative care and all the indirect costs involved, the cost might as well come to or even be more than what would be used in providing the vaccine to be available for the people. So I will say it's lack of implementation from the policymakers.
Dr. Laina Iyambo, a clinical oncologist in Namibia. Now, patients who suffer from cervical cancer have reported the challenges of navigating such a devastating diagnosis. From misconceptions by friends and family, a lack of understanding of what the disease is, and high costs of treatment. I spoke to Margaret Simunja, who was diagnosed with cervical cancer in 2016, a revelation that upended her life. Let's listen.
Thank you for agreeing to talk to us despite what you're going through. We are very, very grateful. Mm-hmm. I would like us to go back to that day when you were told that you had cervical cancer. What was your reaction receiving the news?
It was a shocking one, but I was so strong that I can expect anything in life. I understood it. I was strong enough.
Before that, had you been going to hospitals, maybe trying to understand what was wrong with you, and how did you get to that point where that diagnosis was made?
I had an abdomen pain and bleeding. Then I went to the pap smear where they found out that there's something strange. Then I ignored it. Then it took me almost 4 years because I was just thinking that if it's cancer, mm-hmm. I had that cancer, it's something very painful, but I'm not feeling anything. Then my doctor informed me that Margaret, there's cancer. And cancer in Namibia now is an alarming stage now. Will you be able to go and get that removed? Then I went to one doctor who was ready to remove my womb and said no. Then in 2016, he gave me another doctor. He informed me so well that I accept the results.
So the second doctor that you saw, did they also suggest that you needed to remove your womb?
Yes. So he referred me to South Africa so they can remove my womb. Was not easy at all. And then they opened, then they closed it again, and they didn't remove anything. After 3 days, it was worse. I found myself in ICU. At least I stayed there almost for 15 days there. From there, I recovered from ICU where my sisters were there. They fly to Cape Town, told me that straight from there, I would go for chemotherapy and radiotherapy. I didn't know what's radiotherapy and chemotherapy. I used to read it, but I don't know how it looks like.
So how well informed did you feel all along this process? And did you feel that the medical doctors in Namibia were able to really explain to you what was going on so that you can understand better?
Dr. Roberts explained me better and he told me that I'm on this stage. He told me nicely.
So how are you feeling now?
The only thing that really have depressed me is the colostomy. Because I had anal bleeding after the chemo and the radiotherapy. So it was a temporary one. But from there, gradually, I'm developing something new. It's now the hip is what? A lot of things, yeah, that happened to me.
What do you think about the preventative measures or programs or information that's available in Namibia to raise awareness for cervical cancer? Do you think there's sufficient information for people to be aware about this condition?
I only heard once when it was announced in the television or something like that. Awareness, I think it was just done maybe in 2022. They're not doing enough.
Margaret, what would you wish that they can do, and especially the government, to make people aware about this?
Not to say door-to-door, but at least people to understand. It's more regular that the Ministry of Health should try harder to talk to people about that impact of cervical cancer, all type of cancers. Because people are not aware, they only knew that cancer is for white people. But even though my father died of cancer, my mother too died of cancer as well. But we did not know what is cancer, how does it work, how does it come into the system. So that we don't know really.
Is it really expensive to get treated for cancer in Namibia?
Yeah. Like my case, I was treated privately. Without a medical aid, really, I was told to go to a private hospital because the state hospital, sometimes the machines are off, patients are many, they might delay my treatment, so it's very expensive.
Are you able to tell us what you did or what your family did to be able to meet the costs?
I only meet my cost on my own. to improve my medical aid, to pay more money to my medical aid so that they can cover me fully. So I had to top up.
So, Margaret, to the young women that would be listening to you tell your story today, what kind of advice would you give them?
What I will give them is only to eat healthy, because there's a certain food that cancer doesn't like in your body, to avoid sugar, to avoid wheat.
And should they maybe perhaps also consider going for regular screening?
Yes, regular screening, early detection is convenient.
All right. Thank you, Margaret. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
Margaret Simunja in Windhoek, Namibia. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service. It's been more than 30 years since the roar of Formula One engines was heard on African soil. Now, a race is underway to bring F1 back to the continent in 2027, with two nations vying for pole position, South Africa and Rwanda. Rwanda already has a strong backing from motorsport's governing body, the FIA. The country aspires to become a new destination for the world's top Formula One drivers, many of whom are already assessing the unique challenges a racing track in Rwanda could offer. Drivers like Charles Leclerc, Max Verstappen, and first Lando Norris were recently there and shared their views on Rwanda's potential.
It's natural. Around here, if you go for a cycle or for a run, it's tough. I think for racing, it'll be a perfect place to have a circuit, so I'm excited.
A lot of up and down, I think, would be amazing. A lot of fast corners, that is always what I like.
If there's one thing I'll look forward to if we ever race here, will be the overtaking opportunities.
Here is Rwanda's Chief Tourism Officer, Irene Murerwa.
No ambition is small in Rwanda. The country is ready and has set the tone to be sending a message to the whole world, but also the African nations, to say it's possible. Africa can do it. Rwanda can do it. And we have the capacity and the capabilities to do so.
Meanwhile, South Africa, which last hosted an African Grand Prix in 1993 at the Kyalami racetrack, remains a strong contender. The sports minister, Gaetan McKenzie, has established a committee to spearhead the country's bid.
I think you remember when the World Cup came here, a lot of people said it's a waste of money. F1 is not a one-day event. It's got an average of 5 days that people are in your country. So there's big spin-offs for job creation, economic benefits, massive showcasing the country.
BBC reporter Kelvin Kimathi has been looking at the prospects of both Rwanda and South Africa, including the economic benefits of hosting a major sporting event like Formula One. I asked him, who stands a better chance here?
Both countries still stand a chance because they are still in the bidding process. Rwanda have submitted their bid officially and they are seemingly ahead, and they seem to get a lot of support at the moment during the FIA Awards in Kigali last year. And them just getting that chance of hosting the FIA Awards, the first time it's been in Africa, was big for them because they got the chance to pitch it live to show the FIA and all the motorsport stakeholders what Rwanda is capable of. There is a plan to build a track around 25 kilometers from the capital Kigali in Bugesera, near the new Bugesera International Airport. Rwanda seems to be ahead in this race so far, but also South Africa stands a good chance because it's the only African country with a modern standard Formula One track, the Kyalami Circuit, which hosted the last African Grand Prix back in 1993.
But how much political and financial backing do these bids have from their respective governments?
Yeah, the sports minister has been quite vocal about it, and he says that they've already secured actually some investment from private investors, and him talking on behalf of the South African government shows the commitment that they have organizing a committee to push their bid, and also they've already started work to upgrade the Kyalami Circuit. That shows the commitment that South Africa has, but Rwanda has been more vocal and their commitment has been out there. there because the president of the country, His Excellency Paul Kagame, launched their bid officially. And I spoke to some of the government officials over there, especially the Rwanda Automobile Club president, Charles Gakoya, and he told me no matter how much it will cost, it will have to be done and done at the best and the highest standards possible. For South Africa, having an organizing committee pushing for upgrades that are already happening, it shows that they do have the political goodwill from the government through the sports ministry.
So South Africa might know what to expect because they have a circuit, like you mentioned, but this would be the first time Rwanda is hosting a motorsports event of this scale. Formula One is one of the most televised sports in the world. You see pretty much everything as a fan watching. What are some of the challenges do you think they might face just trying to host this for the first time?
Definitely, they do need a lot of infrastructure. Apart from the circuit itself, where the race will be, it's not a 5-minute job. They have a lot of work to do in terms of having enough hotels around the area, the transport, and all the other infrastructure to support hosting Formula One Grand Prix. So a lot of it is into infrastructure. But also remember, Rwanda is not new to sports events or sports exhibitions. They've hosted Basketball Africa League, one of the biggest leagues on the continent. They've hosted some of the most important and global events like the FIFA Congress and all that stuff. So they do show they sort of have some experience and the willpower to do that, but it need a lot of investment. The circuit is out of Kigali. So making sure the roads linking that from Kigali to Bugesera, it's a lot of work, and Rwanda really needs to work faster, and they have a lot of pressure than South Africa because South Africa, they have everything ready. South Africa has Cape Town, Joburg, they do have Pretoria, some of the best cities in the world, so it's easy to host. And also the companies that sell luxury goods, they will be comfortable going over there because also remember somehow F1 is associated being in quotes rich man's sport. So the people that are coming there in the country, you'd say they're high spenders, and high spenders need proper hotels. They do need the best infrastructure they can get.
Yeah, South Africa, you know, may be ahead in several aspects in terms of the infrastructure. But if we were to talk about the circuit that they have at Kyalami, the last time there was a race there is 1993. You would know, Kevin, that that's a long time ago. So a lot of upgrades would be needed, but do we have an idea of how challenging that would be and what exactly would be needed to bring it to the standard of what Formula One circuits look like today?
Yes, actually, the upgrades are already ongoing. It's expected to cost around 177 million rands, and the upgrades are set to be completed by 2027. Some of the areas they are upgrading as far as Kyalami circuit is concerned is the runoff areas, widening the areas where the cars can run off the track. The pit lane entry also needs to be expanded. They're also improving spectator facilities, the seating for the spectators, because obviously the fan base of Formula One has widened now. It's on the continent, especially South Africa. So they do need to improve the seating facility and also that area to accommodate more fans. Also the access roads, improving the roads that lead to the circuit. There's also the tech pro barriers. They have to add barriers to protect the spectators. They're expecting these upgrades to be done or completed by 2027.
What are some of the biggest expected benefits that will come to either South Africa or Rwanda, should they be able to host a race?
A lot of economic benefits. You're talking a spin-off of jobs from the local businesses, especially the hospitality industry. Talk about the hotels. A single Formula One team comes with a lot of members. Talk about the engineers, the directors, the technicians. It's massive in terms of the jobs. Nearly all hotels in the cities where these races are held will be fully booked. So that's a lot of money coming into whether it's Kigali or Joburg, but also the motorsports industries and federations in those specific countries, the young people there and their drivers and their engineers will get some training through the partnerships that the FIA and Formula One will have with the host, which eventually also will benefit them economically, not only giving them jobs, but also empowering their motorsports industries. The benefits are immense.
And I guess also for the African fan base, which has really been growing, that we simply can't wait. I'm saying we because I'm one of them. Yeah. We simply can't wait.
Me
to have
too.
A race that's closer home.
We can't wait. The moment it's confirmed it's in Kigali, we are booking tickets. Whether it's Joburg, right. We are booking tickets. And you've seen the last couple of years, Charles, we've been to some of the events that have been organized. The popularity of Formula One in Africa has grown immensely. Nowadays, you see over the weekends, people are having these niche meetings to just watch parties, to just watch Formula One races.
So before I let you go, should we have that first Grand Prix in 2027 in either South Africa or Rwanda? Who do you want to see win that first race?
Obviously, it will be beautiful to watch Lewis Hamilton winning on the continent. He's been one of the Formula One drivers that has been advocating for Formula One to come back to the continent. So to see him race in Africa, the only black driver here, the one that's most popular, even though I'm a Red Bull fan, I would love to watch Lewis Hamilton win in Kigali or Joburg. For us, Africans, and every black person in the world, it would mean everything.
Thank you to the BBC's Kelvin Kimathi. Focus on Africa was produced by Nyasha Michelle and Bella Hassan in London. Connie Sharp was the senior journalist in charge, and Jack Graysmark was the technical producer. Our editors are Andrea Lombard and Alice Mudengi. I'm Charles Gitonga. We'll speak again soon.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking, and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.